loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. As the fallout from the Podesta email leaks continue, anti-Russia hysteria continues to be promoted by Hillary Clinton, the mainstream media, and the entire Democratic Party establishment without facts or evidence. The mantra is Russia is trying to swing the election to Donald Trump. After Brexit, is the United Kingdom heading for a split? Scotland could soon enough be independent as the leader of the Scottish National Party signals that consultations on a second independence referendum will get underway next week. The United States bombed Yemen yesterday in what it called limited airstrikes targeting the position of Houthis. The strike comes just days after the Saudi Arabia bombed a funeral hall, killing over 140 people. Does this point to a growing overt U.S. role in Saudi's war on Yemen? But first, we turn to the rampant anti-Russian climate that has engulfed this year's presidential election. We are joined by Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Brian.
Daniel, I want to quote to you from a few media sources just to get started. And this is about the fact that the Clinton campaign, the Democratic Party, and the U.S. government, the Obama administration, and many in the mainstream media are blaming everything that has happened that might be considered to be bad on Russia. Russia has become a principal punching bag. And I want to go through some of the quotes and some of the facts and also the attribution about the latest email hacks from John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairperson, that they were the work of Russia. An assertion made in the media and by the Clinton campaign over and over again, but not an assertion that has been confirmed or even actually introduced by the U.S. government. The U.S. government said earlier email hacks against the Democratic National Convention were probably or confirmed to be the work of Russian intelligence, although they haven't given proof. But I want to start by reading some quotes from the media. Here's from the New York Times. In his first remarks since WikiLeaks began releasing thousands of his hacked emails, John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, said Tuesday that the Russian intelligence officials' intent on swaying the election to Donald Trump has been responsible for the illegal breach into his account. From CNN, federal investigators believe that Russian hackers were behind cyber attacks on a contractor for Florida's election system that may have exposed the personal data of Florida voters, according to U.S. officials briefed on the probe. The hack of the Florida contractor comes on the heels of hacks in Illinois, to which personal data of tens of thousands of voters may have been stolen, and one in Arizona, in which investigators now believe the data of the voters was likely exposed, again, from Russia. And on ABC this week, when asked about the veracity of the Podesta emails, the DNC chairperson Donna Brazile said, quote, I don't know. I refuse to open these documents. I refuse to allow a foreign government or foreign communities to interfere and meddle and manipulate information. So I don't know if it's true or not true. I mean, that's remarkable. Here's the Democratic National Committee saying it's the Russians are doing it. I won't even look at the hacked emails because, hey, it's foreign intelligence doing its job.
I think it's some of the most insidious propaganda I've ever heard. As you point out, Brian, there is absolutely no evidence that the Russians are behind it. They may be behind it. They may not be behind it. The FBI certainly has not concluded that. And if you look at what the Director of National Intelligence said, as you point out, about earlier leaks, it was definitely a lot further than a slam dunk than what George Tenet claimed on Iraq. You know, this is consistent with the behavior of et cetera, et cetera. There is no concrete evidence whatsoever. So what this is a McCarthyite frenzy to try to convince Americans that somehow Putin is over there pulling the strings for Trump with no evidence whatsoever. And I think it is an absolutely damaging to the democratic process that the media allows them, not only allows them to get away with it, but acts like an amplifying, a megaphone for such totally insane talk.
Yeah, I want to also ask you, Daniel, about the timing of things. WikiLeaks obviously is trying to harm the chances of Hillary Clinton's electoral bid? I mean, they're clearly opposed to Hillary Clinton. The fact that they're dribbling out thousands of emails day after day indicates that they're trying to have a political impact on the election campaign. The fact that they released the documents right before the Democratic National Convention that showed that Deborah Wasserman Schultz, the chairperson of the DNC, was violating the DNC's own rules and tilting the primary season in the direction of Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders when both were, you know, candidates, valid candidates, and should have been, the primary voters should have had a chance to vote without interference from the Democratic National Committee. The Clinton campaign and the DNC, they fired Deborah Wasserman Schultz for a moment, but they said immediately, it's the Russians, it's the Russians. And then the whole DNC convention was about the Russians. In other words, they changed the subject from the content of the emails to the fact that this was a Russian operation, again, with no proof. No proof was offered that this was the Russians. Now, WikiLeaks, obviously, again, is against Hillary Clinton. They're trying to do damage to her campaign. But at the same time, the fact that the DNC and all the media can say immediately, WikiLeaks is the agent of Russia. Russia are the hackers, and that is repeated ad nauseum, but it's repeated without facts or evidence. It has the impact of creating a predictable sort of hatred for Russia. I mean, this is a big part of the American psyche anyway from the Cold War. When you look at it, is it just for narrow electoral purposes? Let's bash Russia when the WikiLeaks emails say something bad about us? Is it just trying to discredit WikiLeaks, or is it part of a larger shift in U.S. foreign policy, do you think?
Well, I think first off, I mean, I would hesitate to ascribe motive. I think certainly the effect of the release of the documents and the timing, the effect of it would be to hurt Hillary Clinton. But I don't know if we know that they are actually, their motive is to do that. I mean, so it could well be the case. But, you know, at the risk of myself being tarnished as Putin's lapdog, he made a good point. Why isn't nobody talking about the contents of these emails? Why? Because, you know, it's projection. We want to know how they ripped off Bernie Sanders. Now we just found out that Donna Brazile is leaking questions to Hillary before the debate with Sanders.
And she's doing, you know, that, I mean, in her position because she gets a preview of what's coming because she's also a CNN commentator.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. Why is no one talking about this? But I think what's happening, Brian, to a degree is, of course, they're trying to divert attention from the content. But I think they're actually projecting onto the Trump campaign and to the Russians what they are doing themselves. You know, Hillary, you know, one of these leaks has shown that Hillary was very well aware that the Saudis and Qatar are literally funding, training and assisting ISIS and al-Qaeda. She knows that. We know from the leaks. This is at the very same time her family foundation is collecting millions and millions of dollars from these same two countries. In fact, we just found out today that on Bill's birthday, the governor of Qatar sent $1 million gift to the foundation to celebrate his birthday. This while she knows they are backing ISIS. If anyone's in league with a foreign power, I would say it's the Clintons.
Daniel McAdams, I want to ask you about another controversy. Here at Sputnik, we have been the target of Clinton supporters' theories, conspiracy theories, about Russia's role in the U.S. elections. Kurt Eichenwald, a senior writer at Newsweek, is the source of some of this. He's one of the staunchest defenders of Clinton. Kurt Eichenwald wrote and took advantage of a sloppy error made by a former Sputnik employee who misattributed a quote from an article that he wrote to Sidney Blumenthal. Blumenthal, of course, is Hillary Clinton's close advisor. The text and the information came from the Podesta email leaks. Eichenwald then went on to imply in Newsweek that the entire leak, the entire Podesta leak, was filled with compromised documents as part of a conspiracy between Sputnik, the Russian government, and the Trump campaign. He made the point that there was nothing that Sputnik could have published that would not have been carefully reviewed by high government officials. In other words, it was impossible that there could have been an error made by a Sputnik reporter who was writing quickly and attributed something that Kurt Eichenwald wrote to Sidney Blumenthal when Blumenthal was, in fact, forwarding the article that Eichenwald wrote. In other words, a certainly understandable error. Go ahead, talk about that.
I mean, I just wonder what these guys are smoking. You know, it becomes so bizarre. I wonder if I'm living in an alternate universe. First off, and here's the main thing. It's absolutely, why should we believe that the Russians want Trump as president? You know, Peter Van Buren wrote something last week about it, and a few others have said this. Why is it accepted on its face that they want Putin as president? He shoots from the hip. He says wild things. One day he wants peace. The next day he wants to bomb the heck out of people. He's an absolute loose cannon when it comes to that. Hillary, for all of her bluster, is more or less a realist. She knows the limits of power. She's been in power. She knows what can be done and can't be done. I think an excellent argument could be made that the Russians would rather have the devil they don't know, if they consider her a devil, than a devil they don't know who will change from one day to the next. So it's just the whole presumption, I think, is absurd that they're trying to push for Trump.
Yeah. Again, I want to go back to the bigger issue here. Of course, there's the electoral issue. You know, when you think back about 1948, say the campaign of Henry Wallace, who was running as a third party against Dewey and Harry Truman, and he had considerable support. He was the former vice president of the United States. He was trying to push back against the Cold War at that time. And at the beginning, he had a very, very big base of popular support. By the time the red baiting campaign of Henry Wallace got done, he had almost no support. He was kind of driven out of the 1948 elections. And of course, the Cold War was in full swing. I mean, do you feel, Daniel McAdams, that that's what we're experiencing? In other words, a plunge back into a new kind of Cold War, so deep, so vast, so profound, that anyone who stands up to it, who says even the mildest things in opposition to it, just becomes a target?
Well, I think a couple of differences. You know, obviously, I think history has shown that the entire communist threat was extraordinarily overblown for propaganda reasons to serve the U.S. military industrial complex primarily. But that being said, there actually was communism at the time. There actually was a perceived threat at the time. So in this case, it's a sort of a hollow Cold War. And the other big difference, I think, and several others have written about this, but during the actual Cold War, there were more or less adults in charge on both sides. There were efforts made going way back to the Khrushchev era to reach out, to communicate with the Russians, understanding the implications of things escalating. Those people are gone. The crazed neocons have taken over and are driving us to the edge of a nuclear war. And I think the Russians are right for saying, what the heck is going on over there?
I think so, too. I believe that when you look at what's happened in just the last 2 or 3 years, I mean, in the beginning of the Obama administration, Obama said, we're going to press the reset button. Hillary Clinton is seen in some of these Podesta email leaks as having friendly conversations with Putin. It wasn't filled with venom. That was in the beginning of the Obama administration. But here we have the U.S. now trying to refer Syria and Russia to the International Criminal Court for possible war crimes. John Kerry is at least talking like that, and he's the chief diplomat of the United States. We have the beginning of the building of missile defense shields in South Korea and Poland and Romania, defense shields that Russia and China both are considered to be an existential threat. NATO has launched massive war games on Russia's border. And of course, there was a pro-U.S., pro-West coup d'etat led by neo-Nazi forces in Ukraine that changed the government in Ukraine so that the main goal of that new government is taking the country into NATO. I mean, when you look at the last couple of years, the dynamic shift is pretty profound.
Well, the hypocrisy is just stunning. You know, we hear everything about East Aleppo. Nobody talks about what happened twice in Fallujah when the U.S. bombed the city to the ground. And also nobody talks and nobody wants to see the children that are being slaughtered in Western Aleppo, the government-controlled Aleppo. I was just looking at some astonishing and heart-wrenching pictures this morning of kids being blown up by our so-called moderate rebels. I talk about hypocrisy of putting Russia and Syria on war crimes for East Aleppo. Look what happened in Yemen over the week. And rather than attacking it, we saw Admiral John Kirby, State Department spokesman, trying to justify the Saudi attack, murdering hundreds of people in a funeral home. And his excuse was, well, not every time they fire a bomb, it hits civilians. So it's just stunning. The hypocrisy is just absolutely incomprehensible.
And also the fact that the mainstream media, without attribution, without sourcing, can repeat some of the same claims over and over and over again. the Washington Post, at least in the case of this Sputnik story, it wrote an article finally because it's such an obvious error that a Sputnik reporter made that was then asserted to be the absolute confirmation of a Putin conspiracy to elect Trump. The Washington Post wrote an article entitled "The Trump Putin Link That Wasn't," and then went through and basically showed what Glenn Greenwald and others have done in other part in other media sources to say there was a sloppily, quickly produced article that misattributed the text to Sidney Blumenthal instead of someone else, a Newsweek reporter. In other words, an error. And when you have 24/7 news coverage, errors happen when people are writing quickly. But again, this was a story in the Washington Post that came after the fact. For the first day or two, the headlines were all about, yeah, Putin using Sputnik is trying to throw the election to Donald Trump. I mean, just quite amazing. Daniel McAdams, thank you so much for joining us. That's Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. After Brexit, is the United Kingdom heading for a split? Scotland could soon enough be independent as the leader of the Scotland National Party signals that consultations on a second independence referendum will get underway next week. We are joined from Scotland by John White. He is a political analyst and writer, as well as host of the weekly radio show Hard Facts on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for joining. John, talk about the announcement by Scotland National Party leader Nicola Sturgeon that consultations will begin on a second independence referendum. What led to the announcement? Does it mean the breakup of the UK is imminent? Is it possible?
It is very possible. It's certainly highly likely that there will now be a second referendum on Scottish independence due to the unfolding crisis caused or precipitated by Brexit, and how it has exposed democratic deficit, and something that I resisted during the first referendum on Scottish independence in 2014, which there is a marked difference in the dominant political culture on both sides of the border between Scotland and England. So, for example, in Scotland, every one of Scotland's 32 local councils that make up the government voted to remain. 62% of Scottish voters voted to remain as opposed to 38% who voted to leave.
Just for our American audience, remain means remain in the EU, not inside the UK.
Remain in the EU as opposed to Brexit, which means British exit from the EU. So there's a marked difference. This is something that I resisted, but it's no longer able to be resisted. And if you consider the context in which this announcement is taking place, no one on the left who supported Brexit can now argue that it has done anything other than bring into being an absolute disaster and an unalterable shift to the right in UK politics. We've seen a rise in hate crimes, a rise in xenophobia, a rise in nativism, and that nativism and xenophobia, which is the most significant thing, is now being embraced by the mainstream. Before, these were creeds that existed on the margin of British politics and British society. They've now been embraced by the mainstream, i.e. the Tory government under Theresa May. They're conference just past their party conference, they came out with some of the most outlandish and worrying policies we've ever seen from a British government, i.e. they want British companies to draw up lists that will be made public of how many foreign workers they're employing. I mean, this is really scary stuff. We've not seen anything like this since the 1930s in Europe. And so, as I argued in the run-up to the referendum, including on your show, Brian, Brexit is the UK manifestation of the rise of the far right across Europe. It's a massive victory for the right. Now, in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, I beg your pardon, she has alone come out of the disaster of Brexit with any credibility. The morning after Brexit, she gave a press conference in which the first thing she did was extend a message of solidarity to migrants and immigrants, and EU migrants especially, reassuring them that they were still welcome in Scotland, and that their status would not change and that Scotland would remain committed to allowing them to stay here and to welcoming them in Scotland to live and work. Now, that sets her apart from every other leader in the UK of any UK party who never did anything like that. So Nicola Sturgeon on this issue has been absolutely fantastic, and she set the tone, because now in the UK we are being forced to choose between two competing nationalisms. Scottish nationalism, which is more inclusive, more outward-looking, and a very, very ugly, xenophobic-driven British nationalism, stroke English nationalism. Now, the thing we have to understand is that in 2014, the first referendum on Scottish independence raised a national consciousness in Scotland that has now become entrenched. Jeremy Corbyn, though he's very progressive, he has failed to dent that national consciousness since becoming leader of the Labour Party. The Labour Party in Scotland is still in a very moribund state. It's at war with itself, and it's now been outstripped by the Tories, which is absolutely astounding, given how much the Tories are loathed in Scotland traditionally. But the Tories are now receiving more support in Scotland than the Labour Party, which shows you how parlous Labour's fortunes in Scotland. So with this raised national consciousness in Scotland, this is a prism through which everything is viewed in Scotland, whether it's the economy, whether it's the government, any policy is viewed now through that national prism. So it is now inescapable. And I think that Scottish independence is now a progressive cause to support. I now support it. I was against it before, but in light of Brexit, I now support it because we need to try and stem the rising tide of this xenophobia and this nativism and, on the margin, open racism that is now running rampant across Europe.
Okay, John White, let me ask you, Nicola Sturgeon and the Scotland National Party, they obviously were for a Scottish independence prior to Brexit. They staged and organized the referendum in 2014. You opposed that referendum at that time. You thought it would not be progressive for Scotland to leave. Now you say that it is progressive because the issue in front of the country and in front of Europe and in front of the world is the rising tide of the ultra-right, using xenophobia and hatred towards immigrants as sort of the banner. So I understand that, but I want you to help the audience understand, what was it that was not progressive about Scottish independence before 2014? In other words, why would you and other progressives have opposed it? And secondly, even though this is a somewhat disconnected question, I want to ask you this. Is Nicola Sturgeon, in the consultations that will take place this week about a second independence referendum, is it really about independence or is it a negotiating strategy? What do you think?
Well, that's a very good question. Let me begin with the first part of that question. I was opposed to independence first time round because I resisted the narrative that there's a progressive political culture in Scotland and there's a regressive political culture south of the border. I based my view on class, on the issue of class, and that if we break up the country, it would result in a race to the bottom for Scottish workers and English workers. On the narrative, the left-wing narrative, that a bus driver in England has more in common with a bus driver in Scotland than he does with a rich person in England and vice versa. So I resisted this rise of national-based politics, national-based consciousness that I just described. However, it is inescapable now, in light of Brexit, that there is a marked difference in political culture. And we have to see Scotland as part of a Europe-wide phenomenon. And we need something. We need to make a distinction between this xenophobic, nativist politics that has gained so much traction, because what's happened is in large swathes of England, especially deindustrialised north of England, South Wales, the Midlands, the so-called indigenous working class have been won to the right-wing argument that the problem of dwindling public services, cuts to their wages, terms and conditions and so forth are due to immigration, to something that the right is calling mass immigration, this right-wing notion about immigrants, foreigners, swamping the land, etc., etc. You're getting the same thing with Donald Trump about Mexicans and so forth. It's the same phenomenon. In Britain, it's taking place under the rubric of Brexit. And this referendum allowed this nativism to be given political expression. And the Tory government under Theresa May, who replaced David Cameron, has run with that narrative. And she's now trying to say that the Tory party are on the side of British workers as opposed to migrant workers. And as I say, we've seen attacks on Polish. We've seen a Polish gentleman murdered not too long ago. We've seen an attack on the Labour MP, Joe Cox, who was murdered in the run-up to the referendum. You know, this is a very, very worrying trend that's taking place across Europe. So I believe that the locus of class politics now in the UK is on the issue of immigration and migrants. Migrants, to me, are indistinguishable from native-born workers. They are the same. We have to include them as part of the working class. They're the most exploited section of the working class. The idea on the left that We can come out with a narrative. We can express a narrative that migrant workers are responsible for the reduction in wages. That is very, very regressive, and it's reactionary. No, the narrative must begin that migrant workers are the most exploited section of the working class, and we have to try and bring them into the trade union movement and give solidarity with them so that we can form a larger basis of resistance to the right and to neoliberalism and to capitalism. So this is now where we are. Now, Nicola Sturgeon, as you say, has been very clever in how she's positioned herself, because obviously there are great weaknesses in their first case for independence, especially with regard to the currency, with the fact that the economic case for Scottish independence first time round was predicated on North Sea oil. And obviously that's far too volatile a commodity to base any economic plan on. The oil price collapse. What will need to happen is that the EU will need to grant Scotland a pre-guarantee that if it goes independent, that it will get automaticity when it comes to carrying on its membership of the EU as an independent state. It never got that guarantee last time. Spain in particular has been resisting it because it's worried about its own separatist movement, the Basque Country and Catalonia. However, I think things have changed because the French especially and the Germans and Brussels will want to punish the UK for leaving the EU in order to forestall a dangerous precedence, which this has sounded, because we just had a referendum in Hungary on immigration, and there's a real separatist trend at the heart of the EU, and Brexit has helped to foment that trend. So the rest of the EU will be willing to, I think, admit Scotland on the basis that it wants to forestall the precedent of the breakup of the EU and also to punish the rest of the UK. So I think there is a chance. But the case for independence must be different this time round. On currency, we cannot have the prospect of Scotland joining in sterling, which was the case last time. That's ridiculous. That would be tantamount to Scotland voting to become a colony of the rest of the UK, given that the Bank of England would now have power over Scotland's interest rates and with it its economy. That cannot. There has to be an independent currency. There has to be a much more radical case for independence. It will have to have a look at a different economic model. Now, Nicola Sturgeon is not a socialist. She's a social democrat. But as you know, with social democrats, it's quite an amorphous political ideology and a political creed, and it's there to be won. And so there has to be a fight within the independence movement from the left in order to foment a progressive narrative, a progressive case. Last time round it wasn't. It was a very much a centrist case. That can no longer be the case. We need a marked departure from the status quo. And if we get that, I think we may have a chance.
We're talking with John White. He is a journalist. He's also the show host of Hard Facts on Radio Sputnik in Scotland. John, we have about 5 minutes left. I want to talk to you about your conception there, the working class organizing conception, the anti-racist conception, the response in the changed situation since Brexit. I mean, one could make the argument, and I'll just throw this out to you quickly. I want to cover this and then just go to another quick question. One can make the argument that, of course, that there's been a right-wing change in consciousness within sectors of the British working class, and the people have been gripped by xenophobia or anti-immigrant bias. That happens many times in the class struggle, where consciousness ebbs and flows, it changes, it moves to the right, it moves to the left. Might it not also be the case that if a Scotland, a more left-wing and more progressive sector of the UK, leaves, that that would only, in fact, strengthen the political base of the right wing? And in other words, you can't really give up on the British workers who may have voted for Brexit and may have voted for Brexit for very reactionary reasons, or a mix of reactionary reasons and the fact that they've been sort of captured by a right-wing political orientation, but they are, in fact, suffering because of neoliberal capitalist economic policies. I mean, it's a long-term struggle. Because there are ebbs and flows going back and forth. Are you saying, in essence, that the sector of the British population that voted for Brexit is more or less a lost cause?
At this point, it is, yes, because what you have to understand about Britain, this is not a normal state. This is a major imperialist centre. It has a geopolitical footprint. Its role in the Middle East, its role as a major US ally, are very much a close ally of Washington when it comes to foreign policy and the projection of hard power across the world, with the crisis in Eastern Europe bringing us closer to direct military confrontation with Russia than at any other time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the other aspect of this is, if Scotland were to win independence based on a program that it makes a marked departure, try the nuclear missiles, make the case for an independent Scotland to exist outside NATO, which wasn't the case the first time round, then we're talking about trying to weaken an imperial power and thereby weaken the imperial bloc, the imperialist bloc in the West. So this is another factor in favour of Scottish independence. It's one I resisted first time round because the SNP's case, as I say, included Scotland becoming a member of NATO, but it did have at its heart the removal of Trident nuclear missiles, and it's those nuclear missiles that gives Britain its permanent seat on the Security Council of the United Nations. That's what it brings to the table. Now, if we can weaken that case, then I think we do a lot in a global sense to weaken the imperialist bloc. And that's another factor for progressivism we have to bring into the equation. Yes, the British working class, there is progressives in the British working class. Nobody's saying we're going to abandon them. But I think most progressives in the British working class with a class consciousness would support Scottish independence based on the case I've just outlined regarding Britain's global status.
Okay, John, we have about 2 minutes left. Let me just ask you, going back to the practicality of what's going on next with the Scottish independence referendum, the second one, is Theresa May and the Conservative government really prepared to lose Scotland by pushing for a hard Brexit? Nicola Sturgeon mentioned the hard Brexit several times in her speech yesterday. What are they referring to? Sadly now, John, we only have 1 minute left.
Well, basically, Nicola Sturgeon initially tried to gain a kind of a situation where Scotland would have much more power within a UK-wide setup, much more devolved power. It would have the power to remain in the single market, even though the rest of the UK would not be in the single market coming out of the EU. It wants to have a more federal arrangement. She mentioned that in her speech last week when she outlined the second bill on a Scottish independence referendum. But I think she's cleverly doing that because what she wants to be able to do is go to the Scottish people and say, look, we've tried everything within the UK to try and retrieve the situation and to maintain our democratic rights to remain in the EU given the vote that we took during the EU referendum. Theresa May has been very, very tough on that. I think a lot of that's to do, she wants to play to the right in her own party, but I think she also calculates that there's not going to be requisite support in Scotland for independence, and that the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon are in fact bluffing because they know that. So it's very much a game of who blinks first. And I think Nicola Sturgeon has been brought to the point where she has no choice. I don't think economically it's ideal because of the collapse in oil prices and so forth, but I think politically the conditions make it inevitable that there will have to be a second referendum on Scottish independence based on the democratic deficit that has emerged from the EU referendum and obviously the raised national consciousness in Scotland that I outlined earlier that emerged from the first referendum on Scottish independence in 2014. So both of them are playing a game of blink, and I think inevitably we're going ahead for a second referendum on Scottish.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We're completely out of time. We've been joined from Scotland by John White, political analyst and writer, as well as the host of the weekly radio show Hard Facts on Radio Sputnik. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The United States bombed Yemen yesterday in what it called limited airstrikes targeting the positions of Houthis. The strikes came just days after Saudi Arabia bombed a funeral hall, killing over 140 people, injuring hundreds more. Does this point to a growing overt U.S. role in Saudi's war on Yemen? We are joined by activist David Swanson. He is a founder and leader of WarIsACrime.org. Welcome, David.
Hi, Brian. Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Let's start with the big question. Why did the United States bomb Yemen yesterday? Is this the beginning of a new U.S. engagement in the Saudi coalition's war on Yemen that's been waged since March of 2014?
Well, in self-defense, of course. As I read in U.S. media, this was self-defense. U.S. ships were harmlessly sitting off the coast of Yemen, a nation that the United States has been drone bombing and missile bombing for years, that the United States in recent months has been engaged in a war on with its Saudi allies. That is, the bombs are U.S., the jets are U.S., is supplied to Saudi Arabia. The U.S. military is involved in every step of the way, including literally fueling the jets midair. There are U.S. bomb pieces lying around this funeral where 140-some people were killed the other day. So with this harmless good intention, the U.S. had ships off the coast of Yemen, and someone missed but shot at those ships. And they retaliated in a proper, proportionate, and thereby somehow supposedly legal act of self-defense. Just as we've recently heard about the need for U.S. troops on the ground in Syria to engage in self-defense responses to Syrian attacks on U.S. troops in their country. I mean, this seems to be a new pattern in U.S. media speech, that the United States is able now to defend itself no matter where it is or who it's invaded or what right it has to be there.
I hear you on that. And thus the word, and now oft-repeated word, legal right, is in fact, it seems like, a fig leaf, because Yemen is technically at peace with the United States. So is Syria. So was Iraq in 2003. So was Libya in 2012. I mean, the United States seems to arrogate to itself the right to drop bombs anywhere. If anybody else, any other government, did what the U.S. is doing in faraway lands, they'd be labeled, well, they'd be labeled as war criminals. Let's talk about what, because I think it's confusing for the broader audience that may not be paying careful attention to Yemen. Why is the Saudi government relentlessly bombing Yemen? And why does the United States support Saudi Arabia? And then I want to ask you this, because it seems so, in a way, schizophrenic. The U.S. says al-Qaeda is the enemy. Al-Qaeda was the reason for the war on terror. But as we learn from the Podesta email hack, even Hillary Clinton is acknowledging, at least in private, that the Saudis are, in fact, financing, supporting, providing all that which is necessary for ISIS fighters in Syria. I mean, how can you be waging a war against al-Qaeda and at the same time supporting Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen when Saudi Arabia is the principal financier of ISIS internationally? I mean, to the audience, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, there's a bunch of huge questions there, and we could go for hours. But I think the legal point is an important one to begin with. Whether you declare that two nations are at peace or at war, there is nothing legal about war. None of these wars, none of the seven countries we know the U.S. is currently bombing, in none of those cases is it legal under the United Nations Charter, nor under the Kellogg-Briand Pact, nor is a violent response from the other parties in these wars legal. It is all of it illegal. Why is Saudi Arabia doing this? Why is the United States doing this? Well, you know, the United States for years was using missiles primarily from drones on Yemen, including from a base in Djibouti. And we had victims whose villages were destroyed testifying before Congress saying, look, you are doing what nobody else could do, what the terrorists couldn't do for decades. You are empowering terrorists in Yemen. You are destabilizing the country. You are making people hate the United States. This is all counterproductive. And the United States went right ahead for years. And President Obama, just a few years back, was declaring Yemen the model of a successful drone war. And people were coming up to us, anti-drone activists, and saying, hey, we love these drone wars. They're so much better. In drone wars, nobody gets killed. And we said, look, it didn't replace something else. You created a war, and now it's going to be replaced by another and more violent form of war. And of course, that's now happened. The United States and Saudi Arabia, its partner in warfare and its biggest customer in weapons sales and one of its suppliers of oil, had the back of a dictator in Yemen who was forced to flee as Yemen became more violent, and not just terrorist groups, but anti-government and Shia versus Sunni groups gained power in Yemen. And the United States claims the so-called legal right to attack Yemen given it by a dictator in exile, fled to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia wants to control Yemen. It's on its border. It's not, you know, some distant spot as it is for the U.S. government. And it doesn't like the shift in power. It wants a government that it controls in Yemen. The United States is willing to rush Saudi Arabia more bombs and more weapons and more everything as needed, and to defend Saudi Arabia in the so-called international community from any allegations of so-called war crimes and abuses and atrocities. And so Saudi Arabia sees itself as having nothing to lose in going ahead with escalating this war, and the more people who are killed, the better from their point of view. And yet we know, as you say, from the claims of the U.S. government to be against terrorism and against al-Qaeda and against spreading terrorism, that's what's happening in Yemen is the same as what's happened in a half dozen other countries, that you now have significant growing terrorist groups aligned with ISIS and al-Qaeda in Yemen, which you never had before. And this is what will happen if, you know, we see an escalation in Iraq, around Mosul, in any place that the United States does this. We see the same result, which is the exact opposite of what they claim to be working for.
That was the voice of activist David Swanson. He is the founder and leader of WarIsACrime.org. David Swanson is also an activist and been an organizer for a long time, challenging the legitimacy, the legality, the morality of the U.S. drone program. I want to stay on the drone program for just a moment, because President Obama, as it was reported even in the mainstream media, was meeting in the White House, in the Oval Office, weekly to draw up kill lists of people who would be targeted for assassination through drone programs. And a lot of those people were in Yemen. Talk about its impact on Yemen. I mean, if you can sort of quantify it to the extent it's possible. I mean, how many attacks have there been? How many people have been killed? If we know, and how many civilians have been killed?
Well, I don't know off the top of my head, but we do know. It's perfectly knowable. There has been great research done. If you go to a website I've set up called Ban Weaponized Drones, you'll find links to some of the best research by independent journalists and organizations. But we now have admissions from the U.S. government via documents that have been leaked that it has virtually no idea who most of the people are that it's targeted for murder with missiles from drones, that by its own definition, most of them are civilian or potentially civilian. It literally has no idea. And by the well-documented, down to names and photographs, the reporting that has been done by independent journalists, we know that hundreds and hundreds have been civilian by everybody's definition. But the criteria that the President Obama has put forth for these drone strikes, that the person be identified, that they be an imminent and ongoing threat to the United States of America, as if you can somehow be both of those things, that there be no way to arrest them, so the only option is to kill them, and so forth. We don't know of a single incident in Yemen or anywhere else, in Pakistan, in Somalia, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, where any of these criteria have been met. We know of numerous incidents where many or all of them have not been met, where people could easily have been arrested, but the clear choice was to kill them, where people have been killed without there being an imminent and ongoing threat to the United States of America or to anyone else for that matter, and without the people being so much as identified. We have people targeted based on a cell phone. We have people targeted based on a profile of what they're wearing and where they go and so forth. And so you have this program that dozens of top U.S. officials, at least the week after they retire, blurt out that it's counterproductive on its own terms, that it's generating more enemies than it's killing, and yet it rolls on. And Yemen was, you know, starting early in the Obama presidency, and for the majority of the Obama presidency, the most targeted, the featured model drone war, proclaimed as a success. even as all the reporting on the ground in Yemen was just the opposite, that the country was becoming destabilized, that people were becoming outraged, that terrorists were for the first time ever being seen as heroes of resistance to U.S. imperialism, that opinions on the United States had practically reversed. The United States had been thought of rather highly in Yemen, no more. And so you have a really now a model of the disasters that are produced by drone warfare, and nobody wants to talk about it. They just want to talk about the civil war and the Saudi war as if the United States has no part in it, and U.S. media is talking about the danger of the United States being sucked into the civil war and whether or not the United States should intervene or not. Whereas without the United States, there would be no war. The Saudi government would have no weaponry, and they wouldn't be able to use the weaponry they have because they're using it with the collaboration of the U.S. military.
David Swanson, I want to pick up on what your last comment, because the strikes and the Houthi positions by the U.S. a few days ago, they did a lot of damage, but the Houthis have actually issued a statement, and I want to read it to you and get your reaction to it. First of all, the Houthis deny the strikes on the USS Maison, the boat that was purportedly fired upon. They denied that it came from their territory and said that the report was used by the U.S. to intensify the Saudi coalition's campaign. The statement says this, quote, "These allegations are unfounded, and the army as well as popular forces have nothing to do with the action. The U.S. allegations just came in the context of creating false justifications to pave the way for Saudi-led coalition to escalate their attacks against Yemen and to cover for crimes continually committed by the aggression coalition against the Yemeni people and to continue an all-out blockade." So the Houthis are saying, no, we didn't do it. It's used by the U.S. to, one, distract attention from the bombing of the funeral hall that left 140 dead by the Saudis, and to lay the basis for an escalating role of the U.S. I mean, do you see that coming?
It certainly is a potential outcome, and it certainly is desired by many in the Pentagon and in Washington, D.C., who make very clear that they want escalation in Yemen and in Iraq and Syria, and in some cases with Russia. This is a very, very dangerous situation. The question of whether the Houthis fired at the U.S. ship, is a question I can't answer. It's also the wrong question. I mean, we look at history going back to numerous incidents, most famously perhaps the Gulf of Tonkin incident, where the question was, did the Vietnamese fire at a U.S. ship just off their coast that had been firing at their country? And of course, the allegation was yes, and the truth that we found out and later confirmed was no. But if they had been, that was no legal, no moral, no practical justification for the U.S. to escalate a war on Vietnam. If people in Yemen shot at U.S. ships off their coast, the United States, a nation involved in heavily bombing their country, that would not actually be a moral or legal or practical justification for escalating a U.S. war on Yemen. And so it's an important question to investigate who did it. But it's not a question that bears on the sort of results that people might think as to whether the United States should seek further vengeance on Yemen. There is no legal or moral or practical justification for that whatsoever. There is a desire for it by a White House that wants victories and a Pentagon that wants escalation and profiteers that want profits. But that ought not to be good enough.
David, you mentioned that it is dangerous in the region and in fact globally, and I agree with you on that. I think it said the tensions are razor sharp, the escalation in words, the escalation in rhetoric, the escalation in military exercises and threats. Right now we have, of course, in Yemen, the possibility of a broader war because of the enduring geostrategic confrontation between Iran on the one side and Saudi Arabia on the other. The United States is supporting Saudi Arabia, as we've been talking about. The U.S. now has carried out direct airstrikes against Houthi positions. Iran has just deployed a fleet of warships to the Gulf of Aden for a 3-month mission. It looks like there is an escalating prospect of confrontation in spite of the fact that there was the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran Nuclear Arms Agreement. Saudi Arabia may be trying to provoke such a crisis between the U.S. and Iran because it would solidify its long-term relationship with the United States. In our last minute and a half, I mean, how do you see the coming months, the coming year?
Well, sadly, the expectation in U.S. political circles is that the next president will be Hillary Clinton, who I think would never have made that nuclear agreement with Iran, although she now claims credit for having initiated it. It was made in her absence by another Secretary of State, and she is someone who has talked of incredible hostility toward Iran, as well as in favor of escalation in Syria. And it's her position that now other world leaders those in the British government are using to justify a push for escalation in Syria. I think a combination of Iran being dragged into this war in a serious way and Hillary Clinton moving toward the White House in a serious way is very, very bad news. And we ought to be working in the months between now and January on figuring out how to build public pressure for a completely different approach that doesn't end with cutting off weaponry to Saudi Arabia.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We are completely out of time. We've been joined by David Swanson. He is an activist. He's a journalist. He's a leader in the U.S. peace movement. His website is warisacrime.org. Go to that website to read materials about Yemen and other important issues. That's all the time we have. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.